is out of Top Story. Syria says Israel has launched a missile attack near the capital, Damascus, the second such strike in the past few days. Palestinians facing eviction from a major neighborhood in occupied Al-Quds reject a deal requiring them to recognize Israeli settlers' ownership of their lands. Also ahead, Daesh terror group claimed responsibility for Tuesday's attack on a military hospital in the Afghan capital, Kabul, left over 24 people dead. Welcome to the program. Syrian media say the Israeli military has carried out a missile attack on an area near the capital, Damascus. Still, no word on possible damage or casualties caused by the attack. The strike comes less than a week after Syrian air defenses intercepted missiles over the same area. The Israeli regime frequently launches missile attacks inside Syria, despite the country's repeated calls for action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military as well as resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Activist and political commentator Ken Stone says Israel's Western supporters embolden it to violate international law by allowing it to attack Syria with impunity.
Israel continues to do this in violation of international law because it has powerful backers which enable it to attack Syria, to overfly the sovereign territory of Lebanon, to mistreat the Palestinian people. And these enablers are to be found in Washington, in Ottawa, in London, in Paris, all the Western capitals. The reason that they allow this to go on in Syria is because even though their regime change attempt in Syria failed after 10 years, the U.S. coalition, which includes Canada, France, U.K., and Israel, is trying now to prevent Syria from getting back on its feet and reconstructing itself.
Palestinian families facing eviction from Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood reject a deal requiring them to recognize Israeli settlers' ownership of their lands.
We, the families of Sheikh Jarrah, rejected the compromise offered to us by the Court of the Occupation, which considers us as protected tenants renting from the settler organization of Nahalat Shimon, and which will lead to the confiscation of our rights in our lands. We reject because we believe in our cause and our right to our home and country. Despite that, we are not getting any guarantees to support our steadfastness as Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem from any side or organization.
Families slammed the deal as unjust, stressing their right to their homes and their homeland. They accused Tel Aviv of forcing them to choose between their own disposition or submitting to an oppressive agreement. In October, Israel's Supreme Court proposed that the Palestinian families remain in their homes for 15 years while paying rents to settlers who have claimed the land. The court gave them until November the 2nd to decide whether to accept. The Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood has been at the heart of crackdowns on protests against the planned expulsion of Palestinian families in favor of Israeli settlers. Human rights activist Bruce Katz believes that the Israeli regime's continued eviction of Palestinian families from their homes amounts to ethnic cleansing.
In East Jerusalem, the process of ethnic cleansing continues, with the quiet complicity of Western governments and certain Arab governments that are complicit in that Israeli apartheid regime. The terrorism of the settlers, which is supported by the Israeli army, goes on unchecked on a daily basis. It's happening all the time, every single day. Every single day there is an act of terrorism on the part of Israeli settlers on the subjugated Palestinian population. The way Israel subjugates the Palestinians, we're talking about state-supported terrorism.
Palestinians have marked it 104th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. That was a public statement issued by the British government in 1917, voicing support for the establishment of what was referred to as a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Mona Candiel is in Ramallah.
The 2nd of November is remembered by Palestinians as a disastrous date in history. It's the 104th anniversary of the so-called Balfour Declaration that pledged on behalf of Britain in 1917 a homeland for the Jewish people in historic Palestine, as every year the Palestinian flag was flown at half-mast mourning this date. Palestinians say the declaration was the first official recognition of the Zionist project by a world power, leading to widespread legitimization of the cause and the eventual establishment of Israel.
The Balfour Declaration was one of the worst conspiracies against the Palestinian people. It aimed at depriving us from our right to our homeland, depriving us from our right to have our state, our own state. And it has led to a very severe disaster, which is the ethnic cleansing of about 70% of the Palestinian people in 1948.
The Palestinians are demanding the United Kingdom to apologize for the declaration, and they blame Britain for helping Israel in its occupation of Palestinian territory. But it seems this apology won't happen, Palestinians say, as more world countries harm Palestinians, especially after former U.S. President Donald Trump invented the so-called deal of the century that envisions the Israeli annexation of large swaths of the occupied West Bank. Even after 1 year of his departure, current U.S. President Joe Biden is weak to be able to change Trump's promises to Israel.
Many colonial countries have agreed together to harm the Palestinians and their cause. But our people are still steadfast on our land and dissolve the conspiracies. Trump tried through the so-called deal of the century, first to allow Israel annex the West Bank to prevent a Palestinian state on the 1967 lines with its capital at Quds, and never reaching a resolution on the refugees problem. The UK helped Jewish gangs to have a state on our land. U.S. is supporting them up until the moment.
Palestinians say that the Balfour Declaration has always served as a reminder of the suffering of Palestinians during the decades of Israeli occupation, colonialism, and Judaization. It has been over a century since the notorious Balfour Declaration. Palestinians today warn that the U.S. support of Israeli encroachment into Palestinian territory is as dangerous as Britain's Balfour Declaration and is definitely helping Israel to prolong its occupation and annex Palestinian land. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for a deadly attack on Afghanistan's biggest military hospital. On Tuesday, gunmen stormed the hospital grounds after two suicide bombers set off heavy explosions at the site in central Kabul. The Taliban said four gunmen were killed while a fifth one was captured. At least 25 people were killed in the attack and more than 50 others injured. Daesh terrorists have stepped up their operations in Afghanistan in recent weeks. They have particularly targeted the country's Shia minority, killing scores of them in Kandahar and Kunduz provinces. Meanwhile, the Wall Street Journal says a growing number of U.S.-trained former soldiers are joining the terror group. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg believes that the United States is responsible for the creation of the Daesh group.
Well, this has been going on since the U.S. started backing the Mujahideen in 1978. They were actually busy from then. As the U.S. invaded Iraq, it was clear that it was going to set up ISIS. I mean, it's almost as if the U.S. was showing its hand completely. That invasion of Iraq created a huge new generation of ISIS. And then now, the invasion of Afghanistan 20 years, it's incubated into this so-called Khorasan, an eastern Turkestan version of ISIS. Now, and it's not at all a spontaneously formed group. This is a group that is also has its CIA, Mossad elements that are shaping it and pushing it towards further terrorism.
Ethiopia declares a nationwide state of emergency amid fears that rebels from the northern region of Tigray are heading for the capital. The government has also ordered residents of Addis Ababa to prepare to defend their neighborhoods. This follows days of reported advances by forces of the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Ethiopian lawmakers are expected to approve the state of emergency within 24 hours, while further possible restrictions include a curfew, road closures, and searching people suspected of links to terror groups. Thousands of people have lost their lives since the government launched an offensive against rebel forces in Tigray. Political commentator Lawrence Freeman says the U.S. support for rebels in Tigray instead of the Ethiopian government has prolonged insecurity in that country.
The Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, is acting to overthrow the government of the duly elected Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and has been tacitly supported by the West. If not for the attacks by the U.S. government and Biden administration on the Prime Minister in Ethiopia and tacit support for the TPLF, this effort by the Tigrayan insurrectionists would have died off months and months ago. And therefore, the correct policy should be for the United States, instead of threatening more sanctions, should be to support the nation state of Ethiopia. And that's what all nations and all people of goodwill should be doing. If Ethiopia breaks apart or begins to break apart, this would be a disaster for the Horn of Africa, but also for the rest of the world, because it would heighten the insecurity problem in Africa.
Ballot counting is underway for the governor's races in the U.S. states of Virginia and New Jersey. Republican Glenn Youngkin is ahead of his Democratic rival Terry McAuliffe in Virginia. Youngkin is leading McAuliffe by some 10 points, but it's too early to call the race. Results could signal if Democrats can maintain their lead in the battleground state in next year's congressional elections. President Biden won Virginia by a double-digit margin over former President Donald Trump in the 2020 election. In the U.S. state of New Jersey, Republican Jack Ciattarelli, that is also ahead of his incumbent Democratic rival, Governor Phil Murphy. UK says its stance on the fishing row with France has not changed despite a relative easing of tensions between the two neighbors. Speaking to reporters in Glasgow, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson dismissed the feud as, quote, vanishingly unimportant. Paris and London are in talks to resolve the fishing dispute. On Monday, French President Emmanuel Macron delayed sanctions against the UK. Paris threatened London with restrictions last week after Britain insisted on barring French fishermen from British waters. London argues that the fishermen lack sufficient paperwork, but France accuses Britain of breaching a post-Brexit trading arrangement regarding fishing rights.
The United Kingdom and France have gotten into a bitter diplomatic row. The two countries have been at odds over post-Brexit fishing rights in the British territorial waters. The UK gives out licenses to foreign vessels wishing to fish in its waters, but Paris says some fishing boats have been denied permission to enter areas they have fished in for years. London says the licenses have been distributed according to the post-Brexit deal it reached with the European Union last December. The dispute escalated to the point where a British trawler was seized by French officials, prompting the UK to summon Paris's ambassador in London, a move that's usually made against enemies and not allies. Paris threatened London with sanctions if the issue isn't resolved by the 2nd of November. The UK Foreign Secretary launched a counterattack against France, vowing legal action if Paris doesn't back down.
It's unclear, it's always unclear as to who's correct or incorrect, but usually they are resolved in a peaceful, diplomatic manner. But we live in an age of a growing nationalism in which international institutions are breaking down. And so as a result, a minor spat over fishing rights is turning into a major international crisis.
Threats have raised concerns about a larger trade dispute between two of Europe's largest economies.
Since the Brexit referendum 5 years ago, the United Kingdom has been facing a multitude of challenges and uncertainties. Those include the complications of freedom of movement, Northern Ireland border, and not least of all, the economy. The fuel shortage last month in Britain was one instance, suggesting the extent of the ramifications for the country. How is London, that is, trying to address these challenges? And is the Brexit deal with the EU enough to avert future disputes?
The fishing issue was one of the key points dragging the Brexit talks. Although fishing constitutes a small portion of France and Britain's economies, it holds substantial political significance as it's the main lifeline for the coastal communities. Apart from the fishing disputes, the two countries have recently clashed over the AUKUS agreement, under which Australia dished a multi-billion dollar submarine deal with France for a similar one with the US and UK.
So it's a, the French were appalled, extremely angry by America's peremptory behavior, and they are looking for a way of striking back. And Boris Johnson didn't make things any better by taunting the French when the AUKUS alliance became news, by taunting them in the crudest schoolboy manner.
Britain's departure from the EU has also negatively affected its economy. Official data forecast a 4% economic slowdown for the country in the long run in the aftermath of its exit from the bloc, while the COVID-19 impact is estimated to cut Britain's gross domestic product by 2%. Brexit also cast doubts on the future of the 1998 Irish peace deal, as it would mean a hard border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU. Although the two sides settled the issue, the agreement that has been implemented since January this year has led to the disruption of trade between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, causing disagreements between London and Brussels. The UK government now wants the deal rewritten. Experts believe the long lines and brawls at the fuel stations across Britain are going to be the new normal for life in the post-Brexit UK.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The French President Emmanuel Macron has accused Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison of lying to him over an abandoned $90 billion submarine contract in a significant escalation of tensions between Paris and Canberra. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Catherine Murphy. The piece is titled, Macron accuses Australian PM of lying over submarine deal. French President Emmanuel Macron has accused Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison of lying to him over an abandoned $90 billion submarine contract in a significant escalation of tensions between Paris and Canberra. The French president leveled the accusation in impromptu comments to Australian journalists on the sidelines of the G20 summit in Rome, Italy. He said he had a lot of respect and friendship for Australia and Australians, but that respect between nations needed to be reciprocated. I just say when we have respect, you have to be true and you have to behave in line and consistent with this value, he said. When asked whether he thought Scott Morrison had lied to him by not revealing Australia's secret dialogue with Britain and United States over the acquisition of nuclear submarines, a dialogue that ultimately became the AUKUS pact, Emmanuel Macron was direct in his response. He said, "I don't think I know." Scott Morrison denied he had lied to the French president. He said he had told Emmanuel Macron that he had formed the view that conventional submarines would not meet Australia's strategic interests when the two leaders met in Paris after a G7 summit this year. He said when the two had dined together at the Elysee Palace, at that stage we had not concluded any other arrangements with any other parties. Scott Morrison said he understood Emmanuel Macron's disappointment, but that he did not resile from the decision to abandon the French contract and proceed with the acquisition of nuclear-powered submarines in partnership with the United States and Britain. He said doing otherwise would have elevated French disappointment above Australia's national interests. Emmanuel Macron expressed skepticism to Australian journalists that the AUKUS nuclear submarines would arrive on schedule. He noted there was an 18-month review of the feasibility of the arrangement and quipped, "Good luck." Morrison said he was confident the acquisition would proceed as planned. Under the AUKUS pact, Morrison dumped a contract with France to build 12 diesel-powered submarines in favor of a deal with the United States for at least 8 nuclear-powered submarines. France said it had been betrayed, stabbed in the back, and deceived. The escalation in tensions comes before a meeting between Australia's Foreign Minister Maryse Payne and her French counterpart, designed to get the relationship back on track. The dispute with France dominated Scott Morrison's trip to Rome for the G20 summit. Shortly after Morrison had arrived in Italy, US President Joe Biden moved to repair his own damaged personal and political relationship with Emmanuel Macron by acknowledging that the AUKUS announcement had been a clumsy episode handled with a lack of grace. President Biden told President Macron, with television cameras present, that he was under the impression that France had been informed about Australia's intention to ditch the contract long before the AUKUS pact was revealed publicly. It was unclear whether the US president was rebuking Scott Morrison or his own senior staff for failing to inform him of the nuances of the deal. After President Biden's public rapprochement with Emmanuel Macron, Scott Morrison doubled down on the decision to proceed with the nuclear submarines. He said his government had kept the Biden administration up to date with the status of the conversations and discussions with the French government. President Macron met a number of other world leaders while at the G20 summit in Rome, but he did not schedule a bilateral discussion with Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison. Australia's Prime Minister will see Emmanuel Macron again at the COP26 summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Scott Morrison departed Rome, Italy for Scotland on Sunday evening, 31st of October.
thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and here is another thought-provoking saying from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, from his cousin and father-in-law, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. O Ali, three characters are high moral standards. These are regard for the one who ruptured relations with you, granting the one who deprived you, and pardoning the one who wronged you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا
your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were looking at human rights in the eyes of Amir al-Mu'mineen wa Sayyid al-Mu'ahideen, Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when it comes to taking the lives of other people, we mentioned in many episodes, he take it extremely seriously. Now a person may ask, or may raise a question, and says, well, Amir al-Mu'mineen, he himself, he went through battles, the battle of Al-Jamal, the camel, Safin, Nahrawan, and thousands of Muslims were killed. Only in the battle of Camel, they say up to 20,000 people got killed. 15 to 20,000 Muslims got killed. So how is that fair when Amir al-Mu'mineen talks about, you know, the sanctity of a life and how life should be preserved? Fair enough. It's a fair question, right? Amir al-Mu'mineen, he himself answers this. He says, قَتَلُوا شِيعَتِي وَعُمَّالِي. Talha wa Zubair and Aisha, when they went to Basra, what they did is they killed the governor of Basra, which was appointed by Amir al-Mu'mineen, and they killed some of the Shia were in Basra. فَسَأَلْتُهُمْ أَنْ يَدْفَعُ لِي قَتَلَةَ أَخْوَتِي أَقْتُلُهُمْ بِهِمْ. And I asked them to give me those who killed my brother so I can take qisas, so I can take retribution and kill them for that. ثُمَّ كِتَابُ اللَّهِ بَيْنِي وَبَيْنَهُمْ. And I will obviously judge based on the book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's the judge between us and them. And he says, فَأَبَوْ عَلَيْهِ. They denied me that right. They denied me to do qisas on those who killed my governor and my Shia. فَقَاتَلُونِي. On top of that, they went to war against me. I didn't come to war against them. وَفِي أَعْنَاقِهِمْ بَيْعَتِي. And they were meant to be subjected to me. I'm their imam of their time. They have no right to go against me. Even if he was a khalifa like all the other khulafa, because that's the notion that if he's a khalifa, you have to obey him. So why should you obey the other ones, but not Ali ibn Abi Talib? So when he looks at Aisha, Talha and Zubayr, he said, these guys killed. They refused to give me the killers. Not just that, they went to war against me when they should have been following me. Then Amir ibn Salamullah alayhi says, وَدِمَا أَلْفِ رَجْلٍ مِّن شِيَعَتِي. 1,000 men of my followers being killed by them. And then he comes to this conclusion, فَقَتَلْتُهُمْ بِهِمْ. Then I had no choice but to fight them. They killed over 1,000 of my men in Basra. They killed the governor. They tried to come to war against me. What am I supposed to do? Sit and watch? Obviously, I have to defend. Then he emphasized on this point, saying, فَوَاللَّهُ لَوْ لَمْ يُصِيبُ مِنْهُمْ إِلَّا رَجْلًا وَاحَدًا مُتَعَمَّدِينَ لِقَتْلَهُ. If this group, the party of Aisha and Talha and Zubair in the camel, he said, if they only killed one person willingly, like they killed him intentionally, he said, لَحَلَّ لِي بِذَلِكَ قَتْلَ الْجَيْشِ كُلَّهُ, then that would have allowed me to kill the entire army of Aisha. How many were them? I don't know. 15, 20, 30,000. He says, if they have killed one person intentionally, then I have the right to kill the entire army. That's how serious Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi takes it. Now, let us take a break, then we come back, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. So we're looking at Amir al-Mu'mini, and we said he takes life seriously. But then there's a question that says, well, during Amir al-Mu'mini's time, there was so much bloodshed. So we spoke about the Battle of Camel, for example. When it comes to the Battle of Nahrawan, the same thing, when Amir al-Mu'mini was asked why did he have to go and fight the Khawarij in Nahrawan, he says, لِأَنَّهُمْ سَفَكُوا الدَّمْ وَأَخَافُوا السَّبِيلِ. They spilled the blood and they terrorized people. Now, you all heard the story of this person and his wife was walking and he came across the army of the Khawarij in Nahrawan. And when they said to him, where are you coming from? They started questioning him. They found out that he was a fellow of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi. And they did not like what he was saying to them. So they killed that man. They killed his wife. His wife was pregnant. They cut open her stomach and they killed the baby too. And how vicious could humanity get? And these Khawarij, they were meant to be worshippers. They were meant to be people who spend the night in prostration to Allah and reading the Quran. So Amir al-Mu'min says, لِأَنَّهُمْ سَفَكُوا الدَّمْ, for they have spilled the blood. Therefore, he had a duty himself to protect the blood of the innocent and to give them their rights. And he even wants to protect the government itself from having such barbaric people in such society. So when we look at the notions and the pillars and the doctrines that Amir al-Mu'mineen has to go through first, he has to preserve the life of a person. That is very important. Through either the notion that need to apply the Islamic laws, or at least when it comes to defending yourself. And that's why Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, even we see in a lot of ahadith the notion of taqiyya, which was practiced during his time and after his time, when the Shia, their life was in danger. That you're allowed, for example, to change things, to say different things, to even commit shirk in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as we have the story of Ammar ibn Yasir in the Quran, where he committed blasphemy, but Allah says his heart is content, illa وَقَلْبُهُ مُطْمَأَنٌ بِالْإِيمَانِ, where his heart is content when it comes to belief. So the system of taqiyya, Amir al-Mu'mineen even used it and passed it on to his Shia to use to preserve their blood. To the extent he went and he says, التَّقِيَّةُ دِينِي وَدِينُ أَهْلِ بَيْتِي. The taqiyya, acting and protecting yourself and trying to tell the enemy something else or what they want to hear. He says, it is my faith and the faith of my household. So it is very important for the Imam salamullah alayhi that the lives of people are preserved. And he finds himself a duty upon himself to seek those who killed and to defend their rights as well. Now, Muawiyah, on the other hand, he tried to do the same thing but in an oppressive way. He said, I am seeking the kills of Uthman. Amir al-Mu'mineen says to him, well, I did not kill Uthman myself, that's what you're saying, and I don't know who did. If you know, go take them and kill them. But Muawiyah wanted a reason to go to war against Amir al-Mu'mineen. So he rallied the people behind him in Sham, seeking revenge from Amir al-Mu'mineen. And sadly, today you see a lot of Muslims justify that act of Muawiyah. They say, well, he was seeking revenge, he made a mistake. was a big deal. No, it is a big deal because Muawiyah went and killed and raised the war on people who had nothing to do with Uthman's blood. So Amir al-Mu'minin salamullah alayhi took the life of people extremely seriously. Inshallah, we will continue in episodes to come. Until then, stay with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
صل يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
The Light.
One of the disastrous effects of climate change has been the loss of glaciers worldwide. People around the world are trying new ways to tackle this problem. Now, a team of Chilean conservationists have come up with a creative project to protect glaciers and prevent water loss. The project is called Nilus. Winter rains are collected in cone-like structures called stupas. Experts from Chile are using a technology that was first developed in India to make these man-made glaciers. The water is then later used in the dry summer months. Chile has been experiencing a severe drought for years. Nilus director Enrique Gilona says the project hopes to address water shortages in the country.
Here we are not creating new water. Water is something that is in nature already. It has a cycle, but clearly it has been affected by the effects of the great climate change which we are facing, and we are looking for a solution that actually allows us to protect this water for a longer time in the mountain range to be able to deliver it downstream toward the communities.
The goal is to store some 100 million liters of water across 50 stupas next year. This would be enough water to supply 100,000 people for 3 months. The first prototype was erected in park arenas, an area known for its glaciers surrounding the volcano, the highest parts of the mountain region. Researchers and activists have warned that glaciers in the Andes Mountains have been receding in recent years. They blame climate change for the loss of glaciers and water shortages. A photo on social media, an article, or a TV program can all draw attention to climate change. But to a German artist, nothing seems to be as effective as a journey using a giant water ball to make his voice heard. Arndt Drossel started his journey from his hometown Paderborn, West Germany, 3 months ago. The trip has so far taken him through more than 60 cities. He has completed the journey to the Scottish city of Glasgow, the venue of a major UN climate conference. Drossel says he aims to tell people how they can help tackle climate change, now a key global problem. The German artist believes everyone has a duty to solve the problem to help next generations have a good future.
My wife and me, we have 5 children, and we want to give them a good and happy future. And everybody knows, I think, about the problems our Earth has, and we will have the same problem in several cities and countries.
The German artist says he has encouraged people to make specific promises to tackle climate change. He says his own pledge was to offset all his personal carbon emissions by using the sphere for his journey. Drossel says he will continue his efforts until the promises reach a million. Meet Clarion, a homemade polar bear whose mission is to raise awareness of climate change in a 500-kilometer pilgrimage to Glasgow. The 3-meter polar bear is work of British furniture maker Bamber Hoss. The bear weighs 17 kilograms and is made of bamboo, willow, and tissue paper. Hoss started his journey with Clarion from his hometown of Bishop's Castle in England to Glasgow. They accomplished their spectacular journey ahead of the United Nations COP26 climate conference in the Scottish city. Horst says Clarion is a symbol of melting Arctic ice caps due to global warming.
He's called Clarion. Clarion the bear is not a bear. He is a metaphor. He's a symbol. It is a very obvious symbol that a polar bear represents the Arctic, not the Antarctic, and that is where, you know, some of the problems are with melting ice caps. Not all the problems, because they're elsewhere as well.
Haas says his aim is to encourage people to pay attention to climate change. Environmental activists from across the UK and elsewhere on the continent have also embarked on a long journey on foot to reach the UN Climate Change Conference in Glasgow. Did you know that animals might have the potential to help tackle climate change? Strange indeed, but that seems to be the case according to scientists. The sheep on a remote Scottish island have a special diet that consists mainly of seaweed. This feature is what scientists are hoping can help reduce global warming. Sheep usually feed on grass, and the process contributes to methane emissions. But scientists say the sheep in Orkneys are unique because of spending the winter eating only the marine plants. Listen to one researcher explaining whether feeding seaweed into the sheep diet can actually help reduce gas emissions.
The main thing at the moment is we need to absolutely prove, one, which seaweed is going to be the best for this, what amount of seaweed into the feed gives the best effect, and then can you scale that up to a level where you would actually have an effect on the overall UK farming?
If proven, the Scottish sheep and their unique diet could lead to a breakthrough in methods for livestock breeding, which is a major source of greenhouse gases. Methane is about 30 times more powerful than carbon dioxide in trapping heat in the atmosphere.
Flocks of sheep are on the streets of Madrid. The animals have made their way through the center of the Spanish capital to follow ancient migration routes. Shepherds accompanied their sheep and goats moving through the streets of the Spanish capital. They actually marked a centuries-old annual tradition that began in 1994. The event allows shepherds to migrate their cattle from summer to winter pastures. They do so based on a deal struck in 1418 that allows the animals to walk through the city freely. The event attracts hundreds of people. It was canceled last year due to the pandemic, but this year, many locals came out to watch.
The Philippines is among the countries facing a soaring plastic waste crisis. However, a group of recyclers are working hard to tackle the problem, turning the waste into building materials. The group is called the Plastic Flamingo, or simply the PLUF. They gather bottles, single-use sachets, and snack food wrappers. The waste is then shredded and molded into post-add planks that can be used for decking and fencing. Their products are also durable enough to make disaster relief shelters and urban furniture. The group says the coronavirus pandemic has worsened the plastic waste problem, sparking a rush for protection equipment. Their disposal is a matter of concern now.
Because of the plastic problem we're currently facing, the pandemic, the huge accumulation of plastic use, there's also improper disposal. People are unaware on you know, how do I dispose these plastics? Where do I dispose of them? So at the same time, we give that avenue also, that instead of putting it in landfills or oceans in general, you know, you give it to the plaf, you give it to recycling centers like us, and we would recycle these, upcycle them into better products.
The plaf says surging online shopping is also another problem that they try to address. The group has collected over 100 tons of plastic waste since it started the business in 2019. However, they still have a lot to do. A UN report says some 300 million tons of plastic waste are produced annually, with South Asian countries accounting for 60% of it.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A North Macedonian zoo has a new inhabitant. It may be small, but it has certainly sparked a big amount of joy. The baby marmoset was born 3 weeks ago. Its parents are super protective of their precious offspring. That's why zoo staff have not been able to get close to the baby and determine if it's a male or a female. The tiny primate will be given a name after its sex is known. Marmosets are the world's smallest monkeys. On average, they are about 13 centimeters long and weigh up to 100 grams. The adorable animals can be found in a number of countries in the Americas.
The hustle and bustle of modern life has made it difficult to communicate with nature the way humans used to do a few decades ago. Now a giant statue in the state of New York reminds us of the importance of lending an attentive ear to our surroundings. The massive statue named Water's Soul is located along the Hudson River. Her woman's head, with her index finger pressing on her lips, seems she's asking bystanders to maintain silence. It's a work of 66-year-old Spanish artist Juanme Palenza. He says the message of his work is, quote, to call on people to listen to the profound noise of the water talking to us. Water's Soul was made of polyester resin, fiberglass, and marble dust at a Barcelona studio. It was later shipped to its Jersey City site for assembly. The sculpture is 24 meters tall.
You might have heard of Iran's stellar wrestling achievements or about its soccer team, but that's not all. Another sport has grabbed attention too. Golfers now competing during Iran's national golf tournament in Tehran. This year, 90 participants from around the country played on a very unique golf course. It has only 13 holes instead of the standard 18, but that hasn't stopped golf enthusiasts playing the 13 holes and then repeating the last five to complete the tournament. The good news is that the golf course might not stay so small for long. Iran's Golf Federation hopes to bring in more people interested in golf. But for this to happen, the infrastructure must be provided first.
We don't have the space to use the 350 instructors to train the 3,000 registered men and women across the country, so we decided to build a national academy off the golf course. Course number 18 will be used in a competition venue during tournaments and as a training and education venue during non-competition times.
When the course was built decades ago in northern Tehran, it had five more holes. But over the years, fairways were laid across parts of the field, reducing playable footprint. Tehran's golf club has about 300 members, half are women. Golf has been around in Iran for over a century, and most of the courses are in southern provinces. Concerned about endangered animals? If yes, then it will be good news that a Mexican zoo has welcomed a newborn zebra. It belongs to the most threatened of the three species of zebra in the world. The foal made a public appearance Thursday, 10 days after it was born at a zoo in northern Mexico. It's about 50 centimeters tall. Its weight, between 10 to 15 kilograms. The newborn equine raises hopes for the conservation of the imperial zebra species.
We are the only zoo in Mexico that has this species of zebra. Unfortunately, it is an endangered species. Here at the zoo, we are doing everything possible to preserve and produce them so that in the future, we can repopulate some other parks.
The imperial zebra is native to Africa. It is the largest of the wild equids, the family of horses, donkeys, and other animals. Currently, there are less than 2,500 of imperial zebras in the wild. That's blamed on the destruction of their habitat, illegal hunting, and lack of food.
The world's largest Ferris wheel has opened to public in the United Arab Emirates. Dubbed the Dubai Eye, the wheel takes the visitors to a height of 250 meters, feasts their eyes on the city skyline. That is almost double the height of the iconic London Eye and over 80 meters taller than the high roller in the U.S. city of Las Vegas. Each full rotation of the giant structure takes 38 minutes. The city put on a spectacular firework and light display to celebrate the opening.
The 38th edition of the International Short Film Festival has kicked off in the Iranian capital, with some 63 films from 32 countries competing in the event. The festival has for the first time turned into an Oscar qualifying event, giving winning entries a shot at the Academy Awards. This is being held at Tehran's famous Iran Mall cinema complex, and it will showcase short feature, documentary, and experimental works. 5 Iranian films and 58 from abroad are selected for the grand prize, and the winner will be presented to the Academy for possible Oscar nomination. The jury has members from Iran as well as Italy, Japan, and France. The festival will be running until October 23rd.
Natural disasters often disrupt normal life, but that's not the case with an Indian couple who got married despite their town being submerged by floodwaters. The couple, identified by local media as health workers in Kerala State, managed to reach a temple for the wedding in a giant cooking pot. They could be seen smiling and waving in their ceremonial clothes while two of their relatives were steering the pot. The couple reportedly borrowed the pot from the temple, saying that was the only option available. The pair was unwilling to postpone their big day, adding an unforgettable story to a country that is famous for many incredible things.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.